Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results, made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
This is an iHeart Original.
In 1929, Joseph Stalin ordered the farmers of the Soviet Union to start a utopia. Back then, the USSR was a quilt of old school, frankly, almost medieval, farming villages. Peasants lived simply. They grew their own food and, if they felt like it, sold the surplus. Stalin saw that as a problem. The Soviet Union was industrializing. People were flocking to cities, and many of them didn't have garden plots to grow their own food. Meanwhile, the country's stockpile of grain was shrinking by the day. The situation was so bad that the USSR was importing wheat and rye from the United States. As you can imagine, Stalin hated this. So he cooked up a strategy to fill every belly in the country with locally grown food. The plan? Collectivization. The state would take over farms, and all those old-school peasants would begin growing food for everybody. With the stroke of a pen, the government began gobbling up farmland. It bought new state-of-the-art machinery. It introduced new breeds of high-yield, disease-resistant crops. But there was one problem. Many of the farmers refused to join the fight.
There was sort of a systemic depression among farmers. Now they were working for Stalin, not for themselves.
That's Gary Paul Nabhan. He's an agricultural ecologist, conservationist, and past winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant. He describes Stalin's push for collectivization this way. Imagine you live on a farm that's been in your family for generations. You know the land inside and out.
They have a pride in taking care of their land. They have motivations for working hard to produce crops, both for their own food and for others.
And now, suddenly, the government is handing you seeds and giving you quotas, and you can't even keep the spoils. Farmers didn't take the news well, especially the most powerful peasants, a class of farmers called the kulaks. They simply ignored Stalin's demands. When Stalin realized that the kulaks were resisting, he didn't respond with a sternly written letter. He responded by promising, and I quote, to liquidate the kulaks as a class. Police swooped onto kulak farms. Around 5 million would be arrested, deported, sent to prison camps. Untold numbers were killed. Turns out, exterminating your most successful farmers, is a bad idea. Productivity plummeted. Food became even more scarce. Yields failed to improve. And the USSR plunged into a famine that would lead to the deaths of 7 million people. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Stalin had gotten himself into a bit of a mess. He needed help, and one of the people he turned to was a guy named Nikolai Vavilov. Vavilov was one of the world's leading experts in plant genetics. He had turned the dusty botanical labs of Imperial Russia into the world capital for plant science. And now, his job was to resurrect Soviet agriculture, to turn the USSR into a self-sufficient farming wonderland, with crops sprouting from the desolate scrublands of the Eurasian steppe to the craggy mountains of Kazakhstan. Vavilov would work tirelessly to lift his country out of Stalin's man-made famine. But he was also a realist. He told the government it would take years to recover. Developing new, hardy plant breeds took time. Stalin didn't want to hear this. He wanted a solution. Fast. He needed somebody who would make collectivization work. Somebody who could engineer seeds that could be planted anywhere, any time of the year. So he began searching for a hero. The search would bring the Soviet Union to its knees, and it would force Nikolai Vavilov to make a fateful choice, one between the truth or his life. Welcome to Very Special Episodes, an iHeart original podcast. I'm your host, Dana Schwartz, and this is Seed Wars.
I have to say, I was never a botany kid. I know some kids are, you know, out in the backyard, like looking at leaves, identifying trees. That was never a skill set of mine. But add a historical element and add some characters like Vavilov, and then that makes me care about botany.
My fiance is all about plants and trees. Like I can point to any tree and say, what is that? And she'll know. So for her, this story would be amazing. For me, I was just wrapped up in the Vavilov of it. Like, just, it's so wrong. What happens?
I want to give a shout out before we start to Lucas Riley, who wrote today's episode. So if you like the botany aspects, he wrote another show here called Bad Seeds. So check that out. If you like the repressive dictatorship aspects, he worked on a show called Big Brother, all about the assassination of Kim Jong-un's older brother. So something for everybody. And in this episode, we kind of combine them.
Yeah, totally. And also, the Soviet Union, what's up with how it always sounds like the worst group project in the history of humanity? Like, nothing is worse than, like, I got together with my Soviets and we came up with a plan.
One quick spoiler. We have some superb voice acting by one of the three of us later in this episode. And it's not me.
It's not me. I have my podcast voice and that's it.
This was showing new talents. We might have to do an episode about Zarin's acting abilities and career later on. I don't know if we can get into it now.
And how I draw inspiration from The Hunt for the Red October for my Russian accents.
This is just a fascinating story. We get botany, we get seed banks, we get politics, we get Russian accents. I mean, should we get into it?
Yeah,
let's do it.
When Nikolai Vavilov was a kid, he heard horrific stories from family about what it was like to almost starve to death.
Russia had undergone several famines from the 1860s on that literally devastated the population. There was great traumatic stress in his own family about the dramatic social costs of those famines.
Hunger was a fact of life in the late 1800s. When you went out, you expected to see people's bones through their clothes. It was like living in a world where skeletons walked the streets. But this nightmarish vision fired up Vavilov. He had a dream to create a world where nobody would starve. As a kid attending the Petrovskaya Agricultural Academy, he wrote in his diary,
I want to commit my life to understanding nature for the betterment of humankind, to work for the benefit of the poor.
Vavilov hit the books and became a plant science whiz kid. After graduating, he traveled abroad to study even more. In England, he studied evolutionary theory by poring over the original manuscripts in Charles Darwin's personal library. Along the way, he made important contacts.
Vavilov was in contact with some of the greatest evolutionary geneticists.
One of those great geneticists was William Bateson, the man who literally came up with the word genetics. He also added people like Reginald Punnett to his Rolodex, which, if you remember doing Punnett squares in high school biology, it's, well, that guy. By his late 20s, Vavilov's vast network of connections turned him into an internationally known up-and-comer. It helped that Vavilov was, frankly, a really nice guy. He was one of those people who seemed to have an endless battery, always on the go, solving problems at every turn. He seemed to never sleep, but was always radiating energy and enthusiasm. He carried a smile everywhere he went, and he never forgot the names of people he worked with. Simply, Vavilov was a mensch. And a talented one, too. As a young scientist, he started connecting dots that nobody had ever considered. Take, for example, this idea about plant diversity.
He was the first one to sound the alarm about biodiversity that connected it to our food system. Vavilov was clear that famines were going to occur at an increasingly frequent and severe level if we didn't diversify our food system.
Vavilov argued that if most farms raised the exact species of the exact same crop, a single disease could decimate the region. But plant diversity could prevent these future calamities.
It was a safety net against quickly evolving pests and diseases.
Vavilov resolved to take this knowledge home. He returned to Russia and joined the Ministry of Agriculture. And then his country changed for good. The Tsar is dethroned. The Winter Palace is stormed. Vladimir Lenin takes control. For Vavilov, the new communist government is pretty friendly to his research interests. The Bolsheviks were pitching themselves as a party of peasants' rights. Lenin, in particular, knew the country's poorest needed easy access to food. The famine to prevent is the next one, Lenin said, and the time to begin is now. The Soviets funneled money into agricultural research. Flush with cash, Vavilov's tiny botany bureau would become a plant-breeding mecca. Meanwhile, Vavilov was doing some cutting-edge research. When he was 33, he presented a theory on plant classification that turned him into Russia's top plant science celebrity. Vavilov was becoming hot stuff. Russia's leading botanist called him, quote, the future pride of Russian science. The Commissar of Agriculture compared him to the inventor of the periodic table. Biology, he said, has found its Mendeleev. With Vavilov's profile on the rise, he had the Soviet government's attention. And he made a pitch. If the USSR was going to diversify its crops, if it was going to breed new varieties of plants, then the government would need a library of sorts. A library of seeds.
It was to be the first living collection of cultivated plant seeds from around the world.
To build this library, Vavilov would have to travel and collect every seed variety known to man.
To find resistant and tolerant strains of those crop plants, and then to either breed them or select them to new conditions and uses.
The government listened to Vavilov's pitch and approved it. Soon, the young scientist was hitting the road.
Horseback, muleback, camelback, in small planes and rafting rivers to get to places where he thought he might find seeds that had been underappreciated.
Vavilov's passport grew fat with stamps. He traveled to Persia, Afghanistan, Syria, and Palestine. He explored Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and Ethiopia. He searched for seeds in Italy and Crete, in China and Japan, in Mexico, Peru, Chile, and Trinidad. Vavilov became the world's top seed hunter, bringing tens of thousands of specimens back to his seed library in Leningrad. He didn't just collect seeds, though. He collected local knowledge, too.
He was really the first scientist to listen deeply to the traditional knowledge of farmers.
He'd ask, where do you grow this crop? In moist soil, dry soil, on the side of a hill, in the shade? What time of day do you water it? Vavilov sponged in all of the knowledge he could. And by doing that, he formed another bombshell idea. It's 1924, and Vavilov is in Afghanistan. He steps into a region called Nuristan Province, a place of unspoiled beauty. Imagine jagged tan mountains carpeted with pine trees, valleys of lush, tall grass, rivers blue as a gemstone, all untouched by agriculture. Wandering the foothills, Vavilov is struck by an idea.
He realized that rich diversity of plants are distributed in a few patches, river basins or coastlines or mountain ranges. They had been maintained in place for thousands of years and had diversified into all kinds of colors and shapes, almost like a rainbow of food plant diversity.
That is, there are a handful of places on Earth that preserve a dazzling diversity of ancient crops. These regions are like natural museums. And they are, Vavilov suggested, the center of origin for those plant species. In other words, places like this valley in Afghanistan was where the world's food originated.
The food crops that are the mainstays of every country in the world come from just a few places.
This idea, what Vavilov called gene centers, would turn Vavilov the plant celebrity into Vavilov the plant genius. Vavilov became the most famous plant scientist, not only in Russia, but arguably in the whole world. Vavilov's new theory essentially helped create a manual for making new breeds of plants, breeds that could stand up to drought or heavy rain or disease, even the unpredictable seasons of Russia. Here's Vavilov again with an assist from Peter Pringle's translations in his excellent book on Vavilov.
We have before us the possibility of sculpturing organic forms at will. In the near future, men will be able, by means of crossing, to synthesize forms such as are absolutely unknown in nature.
When Vavilov came home from his adventures with a new collection of seeds, he'd mail the specimens out to experimental research farms that were scattered across the Soviet Union. There, groups of scientists would plant the seeds and observe how they grew in varied soil and climate conditions. Vavilov's work would launch the USSR to the peak of plant science. It would also launch his international career. He'd be elected vice president and later president of the International Genetics Conference. In the USSR, he became leader of 18 different agricultural posts. At the Bureau of Applied Botany, he managed more than 1,500 staff members and was hiring more by the day. Vavilov was assembling an army of scientists, and one of the people to join that army was a kid named Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko was a poor kid with little formal education. He worked at an experimental farm in Azerbaijan where he tended plots of pea plants in bare feet. He was a nobody, but he was an ambitious nobody. And soon he would wreck everything Vavilov had built.
Tired of hair removal tools that just don't cut it? Conair Girl Bomb gives you smooth, flawless results while putting you firmly in control. From achieving that silky smooth skin to boosting your inner confidence, Conair Girl Bomb is all about helping you elevate your self-care game. Whether it's creating a hype playlist, throwing yourself into a hobby, or scheduling some me time, self-care is important to keeping you feeling confident and empowered. It's time to take your hair removal routine to the next level. You can trust Conair Girl Bomb to get the job done right. Conair Girl Bomb gives you the secret weapons for achieving powerful results with ease. Designed with women in mind, these tools boast the Sassy Girl Bomb Grip for unparalleled handling and precision, along with professional-grade blades to deliver results that you used to only get from men's tools. No more compromising. So, to all you incredible women out there, treat yourself to a little Conair Girl Bomb magic. Don't settle for anything less than perfection. Elevate your grooming game with Conair Girl Bomb. Available now at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Trofim Lysenko was nothing like Nikolai Vavilov. Where Vavilov was gregarious and open, Lysenko was joyless and cold. Vavilov had an actual twinkle in his eyes. Meanwhile, Lysenko was gaunt, with shallow eyes and tight, sunken cheeks. A journalist at the newspaper Pravda charitably described him as, quote, stingy of words and insignificant of face. Unlike Vavilov, who trained at universities under some of the most famous geneticists of his day, Lysenko was mostly self-taught. The two men's educations reflected their backgrounds. Vavilov was born to privilege, Lysenko born to peasants. Since Lysenko grew up farming, he believed he knew plants inside and out. He often said that he didn't need a fancy science degree to understand how plants worked. By the 1920s, Lysenko was working at an experimental plant breeding station in Azerbaijan, where he was growing peas. And he was trying something unique. Usually, peas are grown over the spring and summer, but Lysenko wanted to try to grow them over the winter so that the local cattle would have something to munch on over the cold months. And it worked. Lysenko felt exhilarated. It was like he had cracked a secret code, a way to grow plants any time of the year. If this was true, it was groundbreaking. It could increase yields and save lives. He started telling everybody about it, including journalists. When a reporter with the state-run newspaper Pravda visited Lysenko's farm, the writer took the gardener at his word. The story, after all, had a good hook. A young, uneducated scientist who had grown up dirt poor was using his common sense to make scientific discoveries. The writer said that Lysenko didn't, quote, toil in a laboratory away from the land. He went to the root of things. Back at the seed library in Leningrad, Vavilov must have read the article with amusement. Lysenko hadn't discovered anything,
regular farmers had stumbled upon the same trick generations ago. In fact, Vavilov had created an entire department to study the effects of heat, light, climate, and season on plant growth. But Lysenko didn't know this. He didn't read botany journals or keep up with the latest science. So when he made his so-called discovery, he was convinced it was news to everybody. Vavilov didn't resent Lysenko for taking credit for an old idea. The kid clearly had talent, so he encouraged the young scientist to keep at it. In the meantime, Vavilov was curious about Lysenko's methods, so he sent one of his top scientists down to Azerbaijan to check on Lysenko's science. The report that came back was not great. Lysenko had little knowledge of scientific literature, the report said. He paid no attention to pesky things like lab practices or control groups. Lysenko wasn't tracking any data. He was just charting vibes. Up in Leningrad, Vavilov was dismayed by the report, but remained optimistic that Lysenko was just young and arrogant. He would grow out of it. But Vavilov's optimism was his weakness. He didn't know that Lysenko had no interest in learning from so-called elites like him. He didn't know that Lysenko thought universities were, quote, harmful nonsense. Lysenko was one of those people who was convinced he already knew everything. Which is funny, because Lysenko believed a lot of nonsense.
Lysenko was stuck in sort of a 19th century ideology.
To start, Lysenko did not believe in genetics. Chromosomes, genes, DNA, heredity, all of that stuff might as well be fairy dust. Meanwhile, he believed in things like spontaneous generation, the idea that life can just appear. He even believed that a species could transform mid-life into another species, like wheat could transform into rye. And then there were his opinions about evolution.
He didn't understand anything about natural selection.
Lysenko didn't believe in Darwin's theory. Instead, he was what you'd call a Lamarckist. Named after the French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, Lamarckists believed that traits aren't acquired through genes. They're acquired through actions that we take during our lifetime. Take a giraffe. Lamarckists believed that the giraffe got its long neck because its ancestors stretched their necks reaching for leaves. All of that stretching lengthened the neck, and over generations, they passed this long neck to their offspring. To be clear, that is not how evolution works.
Lysenko couldn't accept the breadth and I think the wonder and beauty of evolution as we understand it today.
Lysenko didn't accept that you could help plants evolve by crossbreeding them. Instead, he believed you could essentially train a plant to transform into something different. To be clear again, that is not how evolution works. Up in Leningrad, Vavilov knew Lysenko harbored some weird ideas, that he was a bit sloppy with his data, but he never truly understood the extent of Lysenko's wackiness. Instead, all he saw was somebody who, like him, loved plants. A kid who, quote, walked by faith and not by sight. After all, what was so wrong about employing someone who thinks outside the box? Who knows, Vavilov said. Maybe Lysenko would stumble on a way, quote, to grow bananas in Moscow. He believed in Lysenko's potential. And Lysenko returned that goodwill by stabbing him in the back. In the early 1930s, Lysenko was experimenting with planting schedules. What if we plant potatoes in the winter or in the fall? How would that change productivity? He called this big idea vernalization. These so-called journalists at the state newspaper ate it up.
Agronomist Lysenko's discoveries will lead our agriculture onto a high road of vast possibilities and extraordinary achievements, and greatly increase the tempo of our social construction.
Meanwhile, scientists whistled a different tune. When Lysenko presented his findings at a science conference, most colleagues ignored his work. Vavilov, meanwhile, acted like a good mentor. He called Lysenko's work remarkable and encouraged the young scientist again to keep at it. But each time he sent a scientist down to check on Lysenko's methods, the reports that returned were brutal.
Lysenko is an experimenter who was fearless and undoubtedly talented, but he was also an uneducated and extremely egotistical person, deeming himself to be a new messiah of biological science.
The new messiah of biological science. By now, Lysenko had become a darling of the communist press, and it was getting to his head. In his mind, he was just a poor kid coming up with great ideas that the elites in Leningrad just didn't appreciate, and he was getting sick of the fact that they weren't validating his efforts. So he went out and found somebody who would. In the early 1930s, Lysenko met a guy named Isaac Present. Present was not a scientist. He was a political philosopher and professor, a guy with a deep interest in biology. And by deep interest, I mean he believed that communism and biology were incompatible. Take genetics. Here was an idea that basically said your bloodline determines your fate. It sounded fascist, a scientific way to justify racism. To Present, genetics was metaphysical BS. It had no real evidence behind it, he said. He and Lysenko also took issue with natural selection, instead arguing that plants, at least plants within the same species, were like good communists and didn't compete with other members of their species. Now, anybody who tends a garden knows that's baloney. Plants compete for sunlight, soil, water, basically everything else. But for Present, a guy who taught classes with titles like Class Struggle on the Natural Science Front, that sort of knowledge was the old way of doing science. It was time to embrace a new, communist-friendly science. Now, by the early 1930s, Present took a shine to the young Lysenko. Here was a kid whose ideas were being spurned by his bourgeois bosses. Lysenko, in turn, looked up to Present. Finally, somebody in the upper ranks of academia was taking him seriously. They began to meet and chat about science. After a few meetings, Present decided to become Lysenko's biggest cheerleader, his publicist, his promoter, his spin doctor. Together, they would concoct a, quote, new biology that reflected a communist worldview. Take that idea about natural cooperation. Lysenko would go on to suggest that since plants, like good communists, don't compete, then a farmer could plant seeds as close together as possible to achieve a higher yield. This is a catastrophically bad idea. But Lysenko didn't bounce his idea off other scientists. He bounced it off Present. Meanwhile, he bumped Lysenko's ideas up to his friends in the Kremlin, where he lauded the young scientist as an unsung genius whose ideas were being ignored. Which was true, in a way. Scientists like Vavilov were ignoring him. Lysenko kept pushing to bring his big idea of vernalization to the masses, but Vavilov kept shooting him down, telling him that the idea was best for slow and controlled experimentation, not something that should be forced on every farm in the USSR. Lysenko didn't like getting rejected. Vavilov wasn't a real farmer. He was a phony who spent most of his work year traveling the world hunting for seeds.
He thought that Vavilov was an elitist that was spending a lot of money going around other countries almost on a scientific joyride.
By the mid-1930s, some people high up in government were beginning to feel the same way. After Stalin liquidated the kulaks and sent the USSR spiraling into famine, the government was anxious to recover. And Vavilov, they believed, was moving too slow. The Kremlin demanded new varieties of grain to be ready in 3 years. Vavilov calmly told his superiors that that was not how science works. It would take at least 10. The government did not like hearing that, and Lysenko saw that as his chance. Lysenko argued that he alone knew how to save the Soviet Union from starvation, but elites like Vavilov were holding him and the country back.
Lysenko blamed Vavilov and said that he could come up with a more cost-effective solution to avoiding famines.
Lysenko became more and more aggressive. In 1935, he made another speech comparing his superiors to the kulaks. His bosses, he said, were obstructing progress. Joseph Stalin was in the audience when Lysenko made his speech. He didn't know anything about biology, but he knew good rhetoric when he heard it. He stood up and began to clap.
Bravo, Comrade Lysenko.
The next year, the Commissariat of Agriculture ordered approximately 500 farms to put Lysenko's farming techniques to the test. After the government ordered farmers to try out Lysenko's planting methods, the scientist mailed hundreds of questionnaires to track the experiment's progress. When the envelopes came back, Lysenko threw most of the results out. He kept only 10% of them, the ones that made his idea look correct. His idea was a complete failure, but because he cherry-picked the data and tossed anything that made him look wrong, all of the news reports made him out to be a boy genius. When reality on the ground became too hard for even the state-sponsored newspapers to deny, one reporter twisted it this way. Summer plantings are very good, but because of poor cultivation of the land, we obtained a low harvest. In other words, it was the farmer's fault. In the 1930s, there was a word for people like this, people who obstructed the communist revolution. Wreckers. And as Lysenko saw it, the farmers were wreckers. And so were scientists like Vavilov, who were demanding that he publish transparent data. Even with these silent failures, all the press, the government support, the momentum, was still on Lysenko's side. And as his star was rising, Vavilov's was falling. Vavilov was barred from traveling internationally and banned from receiving foreign science journals. Meanwhile, people like Present were writing articles lambasting Vavilov for not finding fast solutions to the famine. Present compared Vavilov's belief in genetics to religious devotion. Vavilov responded by writing in a journal,
"To those who propose elimination of modern genetics, we say, first, offer a substitute of equivalent value. Let chromosomal theory be replaced by better theory, not a theory that sets us back 70 years.
Lysenko replied in the same issue, calling Vavilov's beloved genetics
a reactionary, idealistic, absurd falsification of science. Genetics is undisguised metaphysics.
Up in Leningrad, Vavilov tried to tune out all of this rubbish. He continued cataloging his seeds, expanding the holdings of his vast plant library. But it was getting harder to stay the course. Vavilov was giving lectures as usual, but now he was getting booed off the stage. Lysenko was getting more fiery, too.
Comrades, was there and is there really no class struggle on the vernalization front? Instead of helping the collective farmers, scientists like Vavilov sabotage things. A class enemy is always enemy, even if it is scientist.
Vavilov usually kept his head down, but he couldn't help but defend the sanctity of science. He knew his old protege was cooking the books. Lysenko was failing upward, and it was plunging the Soviet Union closer and closer to famine.
Our magicians do not take into account the years of long experience of world science. They do not want to hear opinion of other researchers. They want to live in their birthday suits.
In the old days, criticizing the work of a fellow scientist was just part of the discourse. It's what made science, well, science. But these were new times. Scientific criticism wasn't just criticism anymore. It was something downright unpatriotic. In the late 1930s, Stalin issued an order to, quote, fight the high priests of science. It started when the secret police arrested two leaders of the USSR's top farm school. The school's former president, Alexander Muralov, would be charged with sabotage and shot dead. The school's current president, Georgi Meister, would be arrested too. The person to take his job would be Trofim Lysenko. It's unclear exactly what Vavilov was thinking when his colleagues began disappearing, but he clearly assumed that he was next. But over the next 2 years, his number never came up. Instead, Vavilov watched as dozens of the country's leading geneticists, all of them his friends, were declared enemies of the people and rounded up, never to be seen again. All the while, Lysenko began taking jobs that used to be Vavilov's. The Kremlin installed Lysenko as new director at the Institute of Genetics. Vavilov was baffled. The guy running the Institute of Genetics didn't even believe in genetics. By 1939, he was at wit's end.
We shall go to the pyre. We shall burn, but we shall not retreat from our convictions.
The people in high posts were listening. In fact, they were slowly building a case against Vavilov. The State Security Service concocted a conspiracy, claiming that the USSR's agricultural scientists had deliberately sabotaged Stalin's push for collectivization. In the report, Vavilov was one of the scientists named. It said that he and the Institute of Genetics had provided, quote, grist to the mills of anti-scientific theories. Lysenko was happy to jump onto that narrative.
He blamed Vavilov for famines and other disruptions of peasant agriculture that were really caused by the collectivization. Lysenko manipulated Stalin to think that Vavilov's whole point of view was a capitalistic, elitist endeavor.
The secret police had a lot of phony evidence to suspect Vavilov of wrongdoing. He received his higher education in the West, and he was chummy with scientists from capitalist parts of the world.
He was open to dialogue between the Western world and Eastern world, sharing seeds and knowledge with other scientists.
Vavilov believed in sharing knowledge to push science forward, but Lysenko was suspicious of his motives.
Lysenko was xenophobic and suggested to Stalin that Vavilov was both a spy for other country and was sharing secrets with people in other countries.
In 1940, Vavilov was traveling Ukraine, doing his usual, chatting with farmers, examining crops. He visited a research institute dedicated to propagating sugar beets. One day, after exploring the grassy valleys of the Carpathian Mountains, Vavilov returned to his hostel near Chernivtsi and was greeted by four Soviet agents. The men said he was needed in Moscow. Vavilov knew what they really meant.
Tired of hair removal tools that just don't cut it? Conair Girl Bomb gives you smooth, flawless results while putting you firmly in control. From achieving that silky smooth skin to boosting your inner confidence, Conair Girl Bomb is all about helping you elevate your self-care game. Whether it's creating a hype playlist, throwing yourself into a hobby, or scheduling some me time, self-care is important to keeping you feeling confident and empowered. It's time to take your hair removal routine to the next level. You can trust Conair Girl Bomb to get the job done right. Conair Girl Bomb gives you the secret weapons for achieving powerful results with ease. Designed with women in mind, these tools boast the Sassy Girl Bomb Grip for unparalleled handling and precision, along with professional-grade blades to deliver results that you used to only get from men's tools. No more compromising. So, to all you incredible women out there, treat yourself to a little Conair Girl Bomb magic. Don't settle for anything less than perfection. Elevate your grooming game with Conair Girl Bomb. Available now at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vavilov's file contained reports from spies and moles who had been tailing him for almost a decade. Included in the file was a memo: struggle waged by reactionary scientists against academician Lysenko. The charges against Vavilov were broad. He was accused of political betrayal, sabotage, even espionage. Secret police turned his lab upside down. His apartment was searched. And at Lubyanka prison, he was interrogated. Thanks to archived transcripts of his interrogations and Peter Pringle's book, we know how the talks started.
You are arrested as an active participant of anti-Soviet wreckage organization and a spy for foreign intelligence services. Do you admit your guilt?
No, I do not admit my guilt. I never was a spy or participant of anti-Soviet organization. I always worked honestly for the benefit of Soviet state.
You are lying. The investigation is aware that during a long period of time, you headed the anti-Soviet wreckage organization in the field of agriculture. And you are a spy for foreign intelligence services. We demand truthful information.
I categorically declare that I was not involved into espionage or any anti-Soviet activity.
Over the next 2 weeks, Vavilov was interrogated an average of 10 hours a day. The questionings were always in the middle of the night. There was never a break, and Vavilov was never allowed to sit. Looking back, it's clear he was being tortured into giving a false confession, because almost 10 hours into his 23rd interrogation, Vavilov broke.
I am guilty of being member of a rightist organization existing in USSR Commissariat of Agriculture.
In a letter, Vavilov's brother despaired.
His big, useful life is being ruined. His and the lives of his close ones. For what? This is a cruel mistake and an injustice. The end of scientific work. The slander ruining the lives of family members. The threat of it all.
As Vavilov languished in jail, Lysenko assumed the leadership of all of the Soviet Union's top agricultural departments, installing his pseudoscientific followers in important posts. More than 3,000 mainstream biologists would be dismissed or imprisoned. Numerous scientists were relieved from their jobs with a bullet to the head. Meanwhile, Lysenko's farming policies were failing, but Lysenko kept cooking the books and the press kept blindly singing his praises. He'd earned full support of the Communist Party's Central Committee, and in 1948, he'd give a speech declaring Mendelian genetics a pseudoscience. Teaching genetics and cell biology in schools was soon banned. Textbooks were purged. School teachers were re-educated. When Lysenko and his acolytes traveled to international biology conferences, scientists from other countries were astounded by how backward the USSR had become.
The faithful followers of Lysenko prepared their scientific results just to support his fantastic theories. Listeners acquainted with biology were horrified. It was simply inconceivable that such gibberish could be presented in the guise of scientific discoveries.
Indeed, Lysenko became more unhinged with time. Many of his followers declared that viruses don't exist. Around the world, scientists were baffled. The USSR used to be leading the plant race. Now it was totally backward. And all were wondering, what in the world happened to Nikolai Vavilov? After his arrest, Vavilov would be interrogated almost 400 times, totaling 1,700 hours. The interrogations were so exhausting that Vavilov often returned to his bunk crawling on all fours. But through it all, he refused to deny the legitimacy of his scientific work. He also didn't forget who helped send him there. According to his cellmate, a police informant, Vavilov cursed Lysenko as a false scientist. Lysenko's henchmen would say the same of Vavilov. After his interrogations, a panel of scientists reviewed the scientific merit of Vavilov's testimony. Their report confirmed that genetics was metaphysical and that Vavilov was a wrecker. All of the scientists on the panel, of course, were approved by Lysenko. When a judge read the report, he made his sentence.
Nikolai Vavilov must suffer the supreme penalty, to be shot, and for all his personal property, to be confiscated.
Upon sentencing, Vavilov begged for his life. He made an appeal for a reduced sentence, which miraculously was approved. But just as hope appeared on the horizon, the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. World War II hit the motherland, and Vavilov was evacuated to a new prison. Any follow-through with his appeal died with the advance of World War. In the city of Saratov, Vavilov lived in a dank jail basement, holding other intellectuals. His cellmates were an engineer and a literary critic. They had no clothes. They wore canvas sacks and shared a single bed. They barely ate. Vavilov grew skinny and weak. But in the darkness, he found light. His cellmates were thinkers. They were intellectually curious. And so he passed the time in his cage by telling stories of his adventures abroad, giving lectures on genetics and biology. 3 years into his sentence, January 1943, Vavilov would become pale and emaciated. Pain shot through his chest. His breathing was shallow. He had become one of those walking skeletons he had wished to save as a child. When he visited the prison hospital, doctors diagnosed him with dystrophy from prolonged malnutrition. 2 days later, he died. The man who had dedicated his life to feeding the world had died of starvation. Trofimlysenko would lead the USSR's agricultural school for another two decades. But by 1965, it became obvious to everyone that Vavilov was right. Lysenko's ideas were trash. It was a long time coming. In 1949 and 1950, nearly all of Lysenko's summer plantings were destroyed by drought and disease. His belief that seeds, like good communists, could be planted close together had proven especially disastrous. In communist China, Mao Zedong embraced Lysenkoism. The result? The Great Chinese Famine, considered one of the worst man-made disasters in history. Lysenko's methods led to the deaths of at least 15 million people in China. According to Sam Keen, writer at The Atlantic, Trofimlysenko probably killed more human beings than any individual scientist in history. After Lysenko was removed from his position, the study of genetics became acceptable again. 80,000 biology teachers had to be retrained. Officials decided to rename the All-Union Institute of Plant Industry. Coming up with a new name was easy. They would call it the Vavilov Institute. By the late 1960s, Nikolai Vavilov's reputation had been resurrected, and for good cause. Because if you eat vegetables, or bread, or meat from animals that eat vegetables, chances are high that you've consumed something descended from Nikolai Vavilov's massive seed collection. This was especially true for anybody living in the former Soviet Union.
History bears out that what kept Russia fed for the 60 years after Vavilov's death was, in fact, the plants, the crop plants and seeds that he brought in.
In the 1930s, Vavilov's seed collection had totaled at more than 250,000 samples. It was the world's first and largest seed bank. It would inspire scientists around the world to protect the hereditary material of their native plants. Today, there are hundreds of seed banks all over the planet, routinely coming to our rescue. In the early 1980s, for instance, when a parasitic worm was attacking soybean crops all over the United States, scientists stopped the attack by crossbreeding with beans kept at the Vavilov Institute. Vavilov knew his science could have that kind of impact. And when compared to other scientific heretics, he remains in a league of his own. Take Galileo. When he was facing down the Inquisition for his scientific beliefs, he recanted his claims. He caved to the political pressure. Vavilov never caved. Staring down the interrogator, Vavilov chose truth. He never denied the existence of genetics. He never dismissed his life's work. He chose to be on the right side of science, even if it put him on the wrong side of the protege who killed him. In the end, Vavilov couldn't save himself. But he did save us.
So it's sort of a downer of an episode, but I have to say there's a spirit of optimism that I do think runs through Vavilov's story.
Completely. I mean, I came away with a new hero, and like, I never expect a story about like a pair of battling Soviet botanists who would rope in my man Galileo. But like more than that, I also never expect to walk away from the story thinking that my man Galileo was a punk ass, which I did. I was like, dude, but Galileo, yeah. He's not nearly the guy that Vavilov is, because Vavilov was down to die for science and Socrates had that same spirit, but not Galileo. He's like, no, I'm going to cop to the charges. I want to keep my life. Vavilov's like, I'm going down for the cause, like new hero. And also he dies with the most brutal cosmic irony ever.
Yeah.
It would make a very good movie. And so if it were a movie, who would play Vavilov?
Oh, God, we need like a hero. I don't know. I like sort of an Adam Driver type, but maybe I would just cast him in anything.
Okay, I went two ways on this. I went there. You could do it as a dark comedy. And I know you're like dark comedy with the story we just heard. But seriously, imagine this. Nikolai Vavilov, Seth Rogen. And for Trofim Lysenko, Jeremy Allen White from The Bear. Dude can nail the part, right? Also, you need two Stalins. You need a young Stalin and an old Stalin. For young Stalin, some will say it's stunt casting, but I think it works perfectly because he looks like him. Zayn Malik from One Direction as young Stalin. And for old Stalin, Javier Bardem, but keeping it in the spirit of Sean Connery from In the Hunt for the Red October, he does it without a Russian accent. It's Javier Bardem, Spanish accent, but a thick and lush mustache. What do you say?
I just respect how quick and how well thought out that answer was.
Unbelievable.
But okay, I also got an Oscar bait one if you want that. This one's the more serious one. Now imagine.
Okay, yeah, serious one.
The hero, Viggo Mortensen, as Nikolai Vavilov. And then you pair it with that cat from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Charlie Day. He does Unhinged well. So you have him as Trofim Lysenko. Then for young Stalin, it's still Zayn Malik from One Direction.
Okay,
for old Stalin, it's Tom Hardy with an outrageous Russian accent and outrageous mustache. Boom. Oscar bait.
I'm in. Where do I send the check?
Right? Hollywood, are you listening?
Yeah, let's fund this. Let's not put this out because someone will steal this idea and we got to get a piece of this.
Also, by the way, did you guys notice the high priests of science bit? That one line stuck out at me. And I haven't told you guys this, but I have this hobby. I like to collect band names, perfect band names. Now I'm going to put on the list right below Cruise Ship Magician, the high priests of science.
I love it.
That is
I would listen to them.
Very special running segment. So let me ask you guys this. You've both hosted hundreds of episodes of your own podcasts, Dana, Noble Blood, Zarin,
yep.
Ridiculous Crime, and mm-hmm. others. What's your favorite set in Russia episodes that you two have told? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say I have an episode on Catherine the Great's coup against her husband.
Ooh.
And if you have any interest in Russian history, I would go back to listen to that one. I think it's called Catherine the Great and her husband, the Mediocre. They just had a fascinating relationship. And then a real throwback back in like early Noble Blood days. So it's like the audio quality may not be up to snuff, but give it a whirl. I have an episode on the Empress Anna Ivanovna, who built an ice palace entirely to humiliate and ideally freeze to death a political enemy.
Incredible.
That's the way to do it. That's Russian style.
Yeah. That's Russian style.
I don't think we have any episodes set in Russia, though we did go and talk about how for a while the Soviet Union was selling their battleships. And so Pepsi was the sixth largest navy in the world, thanks to the Soviet navy. They've been buying because the Soviets wanted Pepsi Cola. So then they traded their old defunct ships to Pepsi for Cola. So eventually, for a while, Pepsi had the sixth largest navy in the world. So we did cover that.
Well, that's good further listening. If you want to dive into those, I'll put the links in the show description here so you don't have to do too much hunting.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Very Special Episodes is made by some very special people. This episode was written by Lucas Riley. Our producer is Josh Fisher. Editing and sound design by Chris Childs. Additional editing by John Washington. Mixing and mastering by Behid Frazier. Very Special Episodes is hosted by Dana Schwartz, Zarin Burnett, and me, Jason English. Original music by Elise McCoy. Research and fact-checking by Austin Thompson and Lucas Riley. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. Shout out to our voiceover crew, especially Tom Antonellis, a total pro who did some great work in this episode. Hope we get to hear him again soon. I'm your executive producer, and we'll see you back here next Wednesday. Very Special Episodes is a production of iHeart Podcasts.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less.
Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge the season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.